face was the glow, so the angel reflected the glow of heaven, and his feet as pillars of fire. And I think this is in the case that he has come to announce further judgments that are going to be coming from the Lord. And he had in his hand a little book open. I'll come back to that little book later on. And he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth. In other words, I believe that he is indicating by this move that Christ is announcing the final steps to be taken to claim the earth and the sea as his own. When you put your foot upon something like this, it indicates that you're taking possession of it. Just like if you see something on the ground, you stomp on it, that's mine. You know, you've seen kids do this, try to step on a coin or something, which everyone can step on it, says it's mine. I don't know who wants to actually step on it, but anyway, that's what kids do. And that's what's being illustrated here. When the angel steps on the land and the sea, he is indicating that Christ is saying, it's mine, and I am soon going to claim it. Verse 3, and he cried with a loud voice, that's the voice of victory or the voice of a conqueror, as when a lion roars, that is when the lion captures his prey. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. Seven thunders probably refers to the voice of God thundering forth some words. Now, we're not told here what the words are. And as we read on, we'll find that John was about to write down what the thunderings of the voice of God was. And the Lord told him, or the angel told him, don't write it. Let's go on and read that. And I heard a voice. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, so we can say that something was spoken which sounded like thunder, you see. But there were words. And I was about to write them, and I heard a voice from heaven, it wasn't the angel, I guess, saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and do not write them. So here we find in the book of Revelation, the only thing that is not given to us in detail, and the only thing that's hidden from us and not told us, is this little portion right here. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and he sware by him that liveth forever and ever, and I assume that's Christ now on the throne, who created heavens and the things that therein are, and of course that's Christ, and the earth and the things that are therein, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. The reference here to time no longer means that God was going to hold back no longer his steps to take over what he had created and what he claimed was his. This time had ended. There would be no longer putting his time off to take this last step. God was ready to make his claim upon the earth, and all steps now were going to be taken to do exactly this. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, now the seventh angel, when he sounds his trumpet, that will be the final episode in the judgments of God to take back his world. Now, when that trumpet sound, this is interesting, when he shall begin the sound, then the mystery of God shall be finished, as he hath declared to his servants, the prophets. Now, it seems that the mystery of God is going to be an explanation as to the great mystery that man has always asked to have answered. And I don't know where this is one that you've asked, but I've asked it, and I didn't know that God ever promised to answer it. And that question is, or that mystery is, why did God ever allow Satan in the first place to tempt Adam and Eve in the garden? And why did God ever allow Adam and Eve to fall? Why did he ever allow Satan to introduce sin and cause sickness and sorrow and misery and judgment and corruption upon the earth? Why did God ever allow this to happen in the first place? And why did God, and why does God allow it to continue on for almost 6,000 years without interruption? I've wondered that myself. And so during the sounding of the seventh trumpet, God is going to explain to those in heaven, that's the church now, why he has done what he has done. And some even go on and say that God will explain why to all your whys. He will explain to you why you went through what you went through, why certain people were suffered when they went through suffering. All this will be explained. In other words, God's plan for the world and God's plan for individual lives will be explained to them so they can understand it. Now, that will be an interesting time if that's really what it means. Okay. Verse 8, and the voice which I heard from heaven spoke unto me again and said, go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which stands upon the sea and upon the earth. Now, the majority of interpreters say the little book is the same book that you find, I believe, in chapter 5 or whatever it was, where Jesus receives the scroll, the seven seal scroll. That's the little book. The book now, all the seals have been broken and the little book is completely open. Jesus takes the book, gives it to the angel, tells the angel to give the little book to John. Now that seems to be what we have here. Go take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel. All the seals have been broken and this little book is open now, which stands upon the sea and upon the earth, and I went unto the angel. That little book is the title deed to the earth. Christ has title deed. And it tells in the little book, as we have been studying, what Christ will do to redeem and get back his earth, which requires a lot of judgments take place, a lot of tribulation time. And so now John is given the total book. We have not yet read the total book, which, by the way, is the book of Revelation. Now, and I went to the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said, take it and eat it up. And it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up. And it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Now, as I said, it seems to be the same little book that is the title deed that Christ was given by the Father to the earth in the first place, containing all the details of how Christ would take repossession of his earth. Now, he's told to eat it. And the result would be, first of all, he would consider it sweet, but when it went down, it would end up being a bitter experience to him. Now, this is not literal. This is symbolic language throughout the Scriptures. When Jesus said, my meat is the Father's word and not food, he was talking about the same kind of thing. In other words, he is saying here, as you and I would put it, here is the book, now absorb it. Not literally tear the pages out and chew them up, but absorb it. There were no pages. Or another way of saying it, saturate your mind with the words of the book. Or feed your mind on the contents of the book. Or as you would probably say, meditate on the words of the scroll or the book. Now as John first, of course, read and meditated and dwelled upon what he had already been revealed, it was sort of sweet to him. In other words, he said, here is, this is what's sweet. Jesus is going to take his earth back over again. That's sweet. And the wicked are going to get their just due, and that's sort of sweet. And the Christians will become God's people, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and there will be a millennial reign of Christ, and that's sort of sweet. Sin's going to be put down. Satan's going to be bound, and that's sweet. Israel's going to be delivered. That's sweet. So it was enjoyable as he read this. He got excited. Boy, God's going to do something great. He's going to finally put an end to all the trouble and all the problems in the world. Now that's sweet. Then as he began to look at the suffering and the sorrow that already would transpire, and then as he began to meditate upon what was yet to come, which in verse 11 he is going to yet have to prophesy about, he's only prophesied about the first 3.5 years of tribulation. He's got the worst yet to tell folks about. And as he began to look at what he's going to have to tell folks about, and realizing that some of those folks were going to be God's people, then the experience became bitter. And he felt sorry for those who were going to have to go through all the tribulations and all the sorrows and all the miseries and all the agonies and all the torments and all the pain. And so he said, in a sense, it's sweet, but as I think about it, it turns bitter. There is a good side and there is a bad side. And the angel says, but you're going to have to write the remainder of the prophecies for all the people and all the nations and so forth in tongues and kings to read. And that's exactly, of course, what John did, and that's why you and I have the book of Revelation. Now, let's move into chapter 11. And there was given me a reed. Now, we're getting down to something now that you can watch your newspaper for to try to find out, are we anywhere near the tribulation period? We're getting down to some real good stuff now. And there was given me a reed, or a measuring stick, or a ruler, as you would put it, or a tape measure. And the angel stood saying, rise and measure the what? We're on earth now, brethren. And measure the temple of God. I don't know whether you know much about today, but there's no temple in Israel. There's going, the Bible says, to be a temple built in Jerusalem. And the Jews will not rebuild the temple, but where the old temple was, it was torn down by the Roman army. And you know as well as I do from reading various articles what sits on the spot where they need to build this temple that God says is going to be built, that John is going to measure. Well, you know as well as I do that on that temple sits a Muslim mosque, which is one of their most sacred religious places upon the earth. Now, for a Jewish temple to be built on that spot, you know what's got to happen. That mosque has got to be torn down. Now, I don't know how it's all going to happen, but you can watch the news, and the day right now, the Arabs say, man, you tear that down, you got yourself a holy war. So the Jews can't touch the spot without making the Arabs mad. And if they touch the spot, there may be a war. And yet God says to John, you go measure the temple, which says they're going to build it. That's interesting. Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar. Now, you will notice that the only thing that's going to be rebuilt will be the holy place and the holy of holies. That's all. It's going to be sort of a cut down version of the old tabernacle and the old temple. There's not going to be the outer courtyard and the brazen altar and the laver. There's just going to be the altar on the inside, the altar of incense, the prayer spot, and the holy of holies, and the lampstand, and that's all they're going to have. But it's going to be built. And the altar referred to here is, of course, where they made prayer. And them that measure worship therein. Now, we're not told how many people John measured or counted that would be worshipers in the temple. We're not told. But the court, or the outer portion of the temple area, don't measure it. Leave it out. For it is given. Now, notice who's going to possess it. This tells you something else now. It is going to be given to the Gentiles. They're going to rule it. And the holy city shall the Gentiles tread underfoot 42 months. That's 3.5 years. This indicates that at the last of the 3.5 years, a Gentile power is going to control Jerusalem. But in Jerusalem, there's going to be the Jewish temple left standing. And John is told, forget about all the other area of Jerusalem and the temple area, because that's going to be Gentile dominated, owned, and controlled. Of course, you and I know who that's going to be, and we'll get into that later on as we study this. But we're talking about the last 3.5 years now. I want to briefly outline what I'll go into much later on in greater detail. What is taking place, and we don't have it told here, but we have it told elsewhere in the Bible. I'm just going to give you a real quick rundown of what's going to happen. At the beginning of the tribulation period, Israel will make a 7-year treaty with the Antichrist, who will be the ruler of the revived Roman Empire of what you today know as Europe. And chances are very likely America will be part of that area, of that Europe, of that Antichrist rule portion of the world. In that treaty, the Antichrist and Europe and his satellites will agree to protect Israel from the Arabs for whatever benefits, and there's going to be benefits for the Antichrist and Europe. Now, whether it'll be the riches of the Dead Sea, or I don't know what the benefits, but there will be benefits. It'll be worth having, let's put it that way. And so they will guarantee their safety, just about like America's doing today. But they'll guarantee their safety, and the Jews, therefore, will have a sense of security and peace from all of our enemies, because the Antichrist in Europe will claim that they will stand by them and protect them in case of any kind of trouble. So during the first half of the tribulation period, the Jews are going to tell the Arabs to go bump a stump. This is the way I see it. They're going to tear that mosque down, or there's going to be a war between the Arabs and the Jews in the meantime, and they're going to blow it up. I don't know what's going to happen to it. But anyway, they're going to build that temple to the wrath of the Arabs. And they could care less, because Europe says they'll back them and make the Arabs back down. Now, how that's going to fit into your all picture, brethren, I have no conception. I'm just saying they're going to build that temple. And you can look now, if you want to watch your papers, for the announcement that someday, I don't know where you and I'll be living that day, but they're going to announce they're going to build that temple. But I believe it's going to be built in the first half of tribulation period, which means we could be gone before it's ever built. But I believe there'll be talk about it long before the Christians leave this earth in the rapture. Now, I also believe, we have pretty good proof of this, that part of the treaty agreement will be that Antichrist can station his army in the Middle East in Israel. Now, I believe that's what's going to happen. And at the midway point, we talked about a battle some time back, at the midway point, Russia and Egypt are going to go to war against Antichrist in Israel, where you're going to have a war where, we'll talk about this later on, it's going to take 6 months to clean up the dead people. Russia and Egypt shall lose that war, as at the middle of the tribulation period. But Israel is going to get shot good. I mean, she's going to really have her land torn to pieces. That's going to be the battlefield. Alright? At the end of the 3.5 years, the main enemy of the Antichrist has been disposed of. That's Russia. The Arab forces are so disorganized and destroyed that there's no threat from them. All you got left is the Eastern power, which you would call China and Russia and all these. I mean, China and Japan and probably Indonesia and all these countries, the Oriental people, that's the only real world power that the Antichrist got to worry about. But they're not going to be strong enough to threaten his power. And that says something about the military. It seems to indicate that if Russia and Egypt would go against the Europe, that Russia would have the most military might to tackle the war. They would assume they've got the military superiority. But China will not do it, because she does not assume to have that kind of superiority. All right. At the midway point now, the war is over and Antichrist has won. He cancels the treaty. The temple's built. He cancels the treaty, and he sets himself up in God's temple. This is very important. He sets himself up in God's temple and says, "I am God. I am God, and all the world will worship me as God." This really sticks in the craws of the Chinese people. But he tells them, "You will worship me, and I am God." Alright? Now that's the setting as we move into the next verse here. God is going to raise up two witnesses at this midway point to give the Antichrist a fit while he's on the throne in Jerusalem. And they're going to come forth, as we see now, And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. That is, they're going to prophesy the last 3.5 years. While the Antichrist claims to be God, these two witnesses are going to come and say, you ought to get off the temple throne, and Israel ought to come on it, and we ought to worship the only God there is, and you have no right to be on that throne. Now, they're going to try to revive the Jews to get back on the throne, at least get the Jews to put God back in the temple. He's going to try to revive Judaism in the sense of worshiping God in the temple. And the Antichrist is going to be turned this very opposite, trying to get people to worship him. And we'll look at this in greater detail later on. But this is a general setting. And so he has set himself up in the temple as God. These two set themselves up under God's orders to try to put him down and make people disbelieve in him and still serve the true God, especially the Jews. Now let's look at verse 4. These two are the olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before God on the earth. Now, the word candlestick, of course, means that these are God's two light bearers of the truth on the earth. And the two olive trees means they are God's two anointed people upon the earth, anointed for a special task, and we'll see what that is in a few minutes. Somebody asked the question, who are they? Well, I told Mary Lou I was going to tell you, one is Elijah and one's Billy Brunson, but you probably wouldn't believe that. Anyway, we do believe, without almost any doubt, one will be Elijah. Now, we reason because of Malachi 4:5. I'll read that one to you real quick. Malachi 4:5. Behold, I will send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers of the children and the heart of the children of their father, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. But he does say in prophecy, Malachi, I will send Elijah before coming of the great and dreadful day, which is, of course, the last part of the tribulation period. So we're told Elijah is going to be one of the men. Now, Elijah was a man who never died. He was taken up in the chariot in the whirlwind. Who's the other? Well, now, there's not a lot of agreement on that. Some say the other one was Enoch. Enoch walked with God, and God took him to heaven, and he never died. Because he never died, they say that Enoch is the other one. Others say it's John the Baptist. He was so much like Elijah that the two of them would just make a real good team. And John the Baptist was referred to by Jesus as the Elijah of the New Testament. So therefore, you'd have sort of John the Baptist and John the Baptist understudy. Elijah and Elijah's understudy, John the Baptist. Now, some believe that. Then there are those who believe that the other one is Moses. And the reason, and I go along with that theory, that it's Moses. I do so because of Matthew 17, 1 through 3. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter and James and John, his brother, and brought them up into a mountain. And while there, he was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment as white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah, talking with them. Now, what were they talking about? They were talking about the time when Jesus would set up his earthly kingdom. And as you read on in this story, I believe that you'll find this out. Look at verse 10. His disciples ask him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elijah must come first? And Jesus answered unto them, Elijah truly shall come and restore all things. But I say unto you that Elijah has already come. And he's talking there about John the Baptist now. But they were talking about the coming of the Lord. That is, Moses and Elijah were talking to Jesus, who had been transfigured, about the coming of the Lord to set up his kingdom. So the discussion was on the Lord's return. For that reason, I believe that Elijah and Moses have been the two chosen as the two witnesses here in this account in chapter 11. There's a few more reasons why I say that. Clothed in sackcloth meant that they shall preach repentance. That's the garments of repenting. All right? Their ministry shall last 3.5 years. They shall preach that the people should worship God and not worship the Antichrist. Verse 5, this is interesting. They're immune from death. Of course, if they weren't, they'd be killed on the spot. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceeds out of their mouth and devours their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. In other words, they're going to have at their disposal the power to call down by command fire from heaven to kill anybody that opposes them and tries to hurt them and kill them. Now that's going to be, these are going to be weird times, man. But you just think, if a guy comes up and says, I'm going to kill you, zap him. You know, and the fire burns him up. Now they'll have that power for 3.5 years. You can't touch them. And they will have at their disposal the death, destruction, fire of God to kill all their enemies. Now this is biblical, brethren. I don't care whether you want to believe or not. I don't believe they're going to have some kind of super duper ray gun. This is going to be a miracle from God. All right, let's go on and see what else is going to happen. They also have other power to shut heaven. And you know in the Old Testament that it was Elijah who prayed that it would not rain. Of course, it didn't rain. They have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy. In other words, they can say, well, it's not going to rain in past tense for the next 4 weeks. Our next 4 months, and it will rain, brother. They'll have the power to dry up the crops and dry up the land and dry up the rivers and dry up the lakes. They'll have the power just by uttering their command. And it seems as though God is going to be able to trust them, whatever they say. Brother, that's what's going to be done. Now, that's quite a power. You know, all these old fishermen are going to have tough luck when they walk around. We'll dry your lake up, you know. And that's going to be one of their powers. They'll have power over the water. Now, this is why I think it's Moses. Because you begin to see the miracles of Moses repeated. And you have the power over the water to turn them to blood. That'll be something, won't it? All the drinking water passed in be blood this week. You know, and that'll be something else. People dying of thirst. They'll also have power to smite the earth with all kinds of plagues at their command. And notice this, just as often as they want to. That's quite a bit of power. This power has never been given to man before. Not like this. Now, Moses had a power with Pharaoh, but these two men have got greater power because they can do it all over the whole world and do it at their disposal and at their time to sequence. Now, let's look at verse 7. That's interesting. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the end of the 3.5 years now, and God's work for them has been done, to that point they've been protected. The beast, or the Antichrist, and we'll talk about this later, that shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and shall kill them, so they shall be allowed to be killed. God's time for them is over. And their dead body shall lie in the street of the great city, Jerusalem, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Well, that is Jerusalem. I don't know what's going to be called Sodom for. And they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies. You know, until we had tell stars and television, that wouldn't be possible. But you today can turn on your TV and you can watch athletic games in Russia and Germany